Hi everyone, welcome back to season 3 of our podcast, What About Us, Cultural Awareness and Clinical Psychology. You're joined by Afsana. So first things first, I just want to thank all 6,000 plus of you who have been listening in and giving us such amazing feedback. If you haven't done so already, please go ahead, like, subscribe, wherever you're listening in, so that you can be notified of all the latest episodes that are coming up, because we've got such an amazing lineup of speakers this year, so don't miss out. So for today's episode, I was joined by Dr. Irtizar Qureshi. He's a researcher and as well as many other roles. And in this episode, he talks about the REACH UK study that he was part of or leading, where they carried out interviews with ethnic minority healthcare workers to try and understand the implications and impact COVID-19 had on them. It's a great episode, even though I say so myself. But go ahead and listen to it, and I'll see you on the other side. So, hi Irtizar. Thank you so much for joining me on our podcast episode for season 3. So before we start, can you just start off with telling me a bit about who you are and what you do?
Hi, yes. Well, thanks for having me, Afsana. My name's Irtizar and I'm a researcher, a research fellow with the University of Nottingham. I also do some research work with other universities, including the Open University. But that's what I do for a living at the moment.
Okay, so you said you're a researcher. So I think one of the reasons why I got in touch with you was because I wasn't stalking you, by the way, on Twitter, but I'd come across one of your posts. And it was around the research that you were doing around COVID-19 and the impact that it's had on ethnically diverse communities, particularly around mental health. So I guess my first question to you then is, just if you can talk a little bit about how that project came about or how that research came about and then some of the key findings that you discovered from that research.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's actually part of a kind of a long-standing interest that I've had in working with underrepresented communities, including ethnically diverse communities and children and young people as well, because I think sometimes we kind of, you know, box off ethnic minorities as kind of marginalized and underrepresented and seldom heard. And I think that's true. But also I think sometimes within that kind of marginalization, we have whole swathes of groups like children, young people who we don't necessarily kind of consider in that way. So I've had a history in working in public health and also in kind of supporting marginalized communities. And I think when the opportunity came up to be part of the largest kind of research project into looking at the impact of COVID-19 into an ethnically diverse healthcare workforce, which was essentially, it's called the UK REACH study. Mm-hmm. When that opportunity came up, I was keen to try and jump on it and be part of it. And the UK REACH study, it you know, kind of represents a whole range of different kind of universities and bodies that represent healthcare workers up and down, you know, across the United Kingdom. And one of the arms of this research was to carry out qualitative research to look at the lived experience of ethnically diverse healthcare workforces and to look at, well, yeah, we know certain things, we know certain hard outcomes around how COVID has impacted on ethnic minority and ethnically diverse healthcare workers. But, you know, what does that mean? You know, what about the whys behind the whats? Yes, we know. I mean, you know, you'll know and many of your listeners will know about the disproportionate impact on ethnic minority healthcare workers, you know, and that was reflected in the wider community. But certainly within the healthcare workforce in the first wave, you know, you had a massively disproportionate amount of ethnic minority GP, doctors, mm. and nurses, healthcare assistants, and others actually not just being infected by COVID, but then actually dying due to COVID. Mm. compared to kind of British white counterparts. So there was a lot of talk at the time about, well, you know, this could be, it could be down to genetics and whatnot, and all these kind of talk of kind of, you know, vitamin D kind of consumption and things, and but I think once you let the dust settle, it became very, very clear that, you know, some of the variables at play here were more to do with kind of institutional, societal inequities and, you know, a general unfairness that runs throughout society, including in healthcare organizations, which then has impacted on these healthcare workers, resulting in them kind of being infected more and then dying due to COVID more. So the qualitative work that I've been involved with colleagues at the University of Nottingham, with people like Laura Nellums, an assistant professor of global health there, privileged to work with these guys because they really do want to try and get behind, you know, the why of these numbers that we're so aware of. And I think some of the findings that you're asking about, you know, some of it absolutely aligns with the evidence base as we know. We know about these societal inequities. We know that if you belong to certain ethnic minority groups, you're more likely to experience poorer health outcomes, poorer educational outcomes, poorer socioeconomic outcomes. And that translates into the healthcare workforce. We know that these communities are up against long-standing institutional barriers, like institutional racism, for example. But alongside that, some of our research does shine a light on a kind of a cumulative effect, if you like. There's something about being let's say, a migrant worker, someone that's been overseas trained as a nurse, let's say, right? But then when you come over to this country and then you start to work as a nurse, you're often kind of put back a couple of bands. You're put back down the pay scale because you need to go through various kind of accreditation to register with the Nursing Midwifery Council, for example. And so there are barriers in place that notch you back a bit there. So your occupational role diminishes. In addition to that, if you're a person of color, we know that through, you know, phenomenon like kind of institutional racism, that can act as a barrier. So it knocks you back even further. In addition to that, let's say if you are female, then, you know, that in itself becomes another intersecting factor. And you cumulatively start to build up this picture of this one person who actually represents a whole, you know, a whole range of people. And you start to see why they are at a more vulnerable, disempowered, disadvantaged position. And therefore, why they are more likely to be told to go and work on a COVID patient facing ward, which then increases their likelihood of infection, which then increases their likelihood of poor health outcomes due to COVID. So when you start to unpick the individual life circumstances of some of these healthcare workers, you start to see what they're up against and why the numbers are the way they are. So some of the findings I think are really interesting if you take on board the intersecting factors at play.
No, that's amazing. Thank you for providing that kind of outline of what's the sort of kind of giving the context in terms of like what's been happening. I guess what I'm really interested in, so you said that you did qualitative studies with healthcare workers. So what were some of the themes that were kind of being generated through that? And what were some of the concerns, whatever you want to call it, through that research that came about?
So that's a valid question. And it does, with a kind of a study of this scale, there are a number of different kind of themes, a number of different papers that are kind of being kind of published out of that. But one of the themes, let's say, to look at the kind of the mental health burden, for example, or the impact of these factors that I've just laid out for that one person, you know, that one immigrant overseas trained nurse and so forth, you know, what kind of impact, you know, what factors impacted the mental health of that person working during COVID-19? And what you tend to find is, or what we found in this study was, that there are certain factors which impact on you know, detrimentally on the mental health of all healthcare workers, right? So during the first wave, especially of COVID-19, there was a lack of guidance. There was a lack of clarity. I mean, this was certainly for the public in general, but more acutely within kind of healthcare organizations. You know, do you wear masks? Do you not wear masks? At first we were just told, you know, wash your hands, you know, sing happy birthday and, you know, keep a distance from people, be sensible, you'll be fine. And then within three weeks later, it was like, by the way, stay at home, you know, save lives, protect the NHS, don't leave your house. And it was like, hang on, you know, so we were bewildered as a general public, but certainly within healthcare organizations as well, you know, this was unprecedented in our lifetimes. Policymakers and those kind of responsible for infection control, for example, hadn't come across anything like this, you know, before. So they themselves were, well, you know, you need to be, you know, scrubs will do. No, actually, you need to be, you need to be wearing aprons and you need to have kind of, you know, surgical masks, but no, hang on, now you need FFP3s, you need a certain grade of mask. If you're kind of involved in this type of work, you need this. If you're involved in aerosol generating, you know, procedures, if you're in more high risk areas, you need this kind of equipment. The guidance was constantly changing over a very short period of time, literally from shift to shift. Right. And that's what these kind of, that's, you know, some of these interviews shed like really, really clear light on that. And it's scary what these people had to do because it was life and death, you know, kind of decisions being made and people were being told to go into the front line. We often use the term front line, but, you know, you understand the gravity of it, you know, the front line. Life and death situations with unclear, inconsistent, constantly changing guidance on personal protective equipment, for example. Mm-hmm. Now that's going to have a detrimental impact on one's mental health with levels of anxiety being raised, levels of stress being raised. Yeah. You know, that's completely understandable. And that cuts across the piece. That cuts across the piece for you know, all ethnicities and genders and so forth of healthcare workers. However, when you start to, as I said before, look at the cumulative effect of you've got this factors around inconsistent guidance around PPE, personal protective equipment, for everyone. But then you've got a layer of healthcare workers who are facing institutional racism, right? They are facing blockages in systemically, you know, in how far they can get up the system, right? We know, you know, people like Roger Klein and others have talked about the snowy peaks of the NHS, you know, where you've got these, you know, as you start to go up the mountain of the NHS, you've got lots of diversity, lots of people of different colors and so forth towards the bottom of the mountain. But as you get towards the top of the mountain, you know, it starts to become really kind of quite monocultural and white, you know, and there's no getting away from that, you know. And therefore, if you're not in a position of senior management, if you're not at a kind of level where you can influence policy and what and whatnot in practice, then you are going to be disempowered. You are going to be at a lesser position in autonomy, in a sense of agency, in what you can do for yourself and those around you. And therefore, when you add inconsistent guidance for PPE plus institutional racism, that can then lead to a sense of lack of trust in one's employer. It can lead to a sense of betrayal, you know, and we can use tried and tested kind of scales, like the moral injury scale, for example, has been used by Lam and others previously to kind of test out some of these, experiences of healthcare workers. And so if you're feeling betrayed, if you feel like you can't trust the very employer who's, you're putting your life in their hands, you know you're up against barriers, institutional barriers, and there's inconsistent guidance for all. That then leads to an increased psychological burden for ethnic minority healthcare workers. So it's not to say that, you know, it's just one group of people that, have, a detrimental impact to their mental health over COVID-19. No, not at all. But it's when you start to look at the individual, cumulative and intersecting factors, and I keep using the word intersecting because, as you'll be aware, using an intersectional conceptual framework, intersectionality or intersectionalism, as it's been coined by people like Kimberly Crenshaw and others, this way of looking at the lived experience of healthcare workers and others can be invaluable to really get to the heart of, well, what's going on here? Why are these guys, coming out so much worse than these guys? So I think those have been some of the interesting themes around mental health, for example.
Absolutely. That's amazing. I mean, I think you just unpacked quite a lot there. And obviously, I guess there's so many other factors that, as you say, that can obviously embed within that as well and kind of, I suppose, affect or have implications for individuals within that particular workforce. But I guess what I want to kind of touch upon is then, the participants that you had spoke about their issues and the impact that COVID-19 and I guess, their workplace had on their mental health. Did they talk about what they did during this time to kind of support themselves or what support they received from their institute to help them with their mental health? Did that come about through the research?
Yeah, no, that's a really valid question. So one of the kind of more positive themes that we were trying to pick up on was coping strategies. Right. What kind of coping strategies do healthcare workers employ? And some of them were, as you would expect, trying to utilize organizational frameworks and to be fair, to organize, trusts, healthcare employers up and down the country. Some of them did try and did try very quickly to put in place systems and infrastructure to help support the mental health and the well-being more generally of their workers, counseling services, drop-in spaces, in-house mechanisms to help support workers across the piece. Then you saw the resurgence and the real strength of, I know we don't tend to use the term BAME, Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic backgrounds as much now, but that those BAME networks, as they were called, for healthcare workers really came into their own, because then they'd start to provide a voice, a mechanism for many of these healthcare workers to kind of share some of their concerns, to try and get some of their messages through to senior management, to policymakers, to those that were trying to kind of steer the ship and say, well, hang on, we need to consider this and we need to consider that. So there were organizational, mechanisms used for coping strategies. A lot of people went to, as I'm sure, I certainly did as a kind of middle-aged man, during lockdown, I found or rediscovered my bicycle and like a lot of other guys. And it was just like, oh yes, I'm going to go mountain biking, I'm going to go cycling. But it was what we could do to try and alleviate the pressure on our mind in a situation that we weren't used to, right? We weren't used to being cooped up like that. So just like myself, just like a lot of other people out there, healthcare workers themselves found physical activity, outdoor exercise, walking, cycling, running, all this kind of business really kicked into play. And a lot of them talk about them rediscovering those activities to help them as a coping strategy. And I think really interesting as well, faith and the role of faith, not just faith as in like an orthodox faith, going to going to the church, going to the mosque, going to the temple, going to the Gurdwara. Not just that, but actually faith communities, you know, using the network of support that you have through friends, family, and our communities of faith really came into play for a number of our participants. And they, and you know, some of them, you know, there's some really powerful quotes out there where people are quite clearly stating, if it wasn't for my faith, I would not have got through this. You know, mm-hmm. there by the grace of God, you know, they are absolutely putting at the forefront of their resilience, their ability to cope, their strength in their faith. And I think that was really, you know, that was really powerful and really interesting as well. Yeah,
absolutely. So I guess, so I'm just mindful of time as well. So I'm just going to try and not ask you too many questions, but there's so many things I want to unpack. But I guess what I want to ask is, so you kind of looked at healthcare workers, but are there any opportunities for you to then go out into the community and talk, you know, talk to community members and kind of think about the implications that it had on those individuals? Or is that something that you're not kind of doing at the moment?
Yeah, so that's not within scope of the research at the moment, but certainly I do have a, as I said earlier, you know, I used to teach, I used to work in and for schools for a number of years, and I do have this affinity for trying to work with and support the voice of children and young people. And I think that one of the things I'd really like to kind of do going forward is to find out a little bit more about the individual specific circumstances of children and young people. Children and young people across the board, but also children and young people from our kind of ethnically diverse communities, you know, because these kids have had really the rough end of the stick here, you know.
Absolutely.
Like we've had life context to be able to compare and contrast. Oh, well, this is what lockdown looks like compared to non-lockdown. This is what, you know, the educational system is behaving like now compared to when it wasn't. A lot of these young people, they just bang into it as they've got consciousness, as they're going to kind of early mid-adolescence. This was becoming their normality. It was just like, well, is you know, as much as kids might, or you and I may have back in the day, you know, thought, well, I hate school, you know, I don't want to go to school. You're always telling me what to wear, always telling me when to, you know, turn up and what to say, what not to say. But adolescents across the piece, as much as they might push back from things like school, the regularity, the routine, the boundaries, the parameters, the security that school provides, all adolescents seek it. They actually want to be, they actually want to know what's right, what's wrong, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. As much as you may hate your teachers, you know where you stand with them. You know what you can expect of them and what they expect of you. And therefore, to take away that security of school from these adolescents, like they don't know if school's going to be open. If you remember, you know, during kind of early lockdown, it was like schools were opening and shutting, like a revolving door, you know, in the first few weeks. They didn't know if school was open. Then they'd go to school, but they're not being taught by their usual teacher. And then they're being taught in these bubbles with other kids that they're not used to. And then the bubbles being sent home. And then, so all of a sudden, you've got complete insecurity, uncertainty, lack of regularity and routine and a framework for these adolescents. And I think just the psychological impact of that alone, let alone all of the fear and anxiety that comes from countering something like COVID-19 as a child, you know, I think we'll be dealing with the aftermath of that trauma for a long time with children and young people. So I'd like to do a little bit more research around, you know, when you say in the community, I'd like to know a little bit more about how children and young people have dealt with it, are dealing with it, and will deal with it going forward.
Absolutely. And I think that would be such valued work as well, because I think knowing from, you know, young people around my community and the implications that's had on them, I guess that's something that I worry about as well, you know, the implications that it's going to have on them, on their future years, and even how they're dealing with it now. You know, there's a lot of students, you know, especially young people who are suffering from social anxiety and things like that. So I guess this will be really valued work.
Absolutely.
So I'm gonna have to wrap it up. But sure. So I just want to ask you, so we have a lot of people who are early career researchers or are kind of thinking about you know, what they want to do in terms of getting into like clinical psychology and things like that. So what would be some of your advice as a researcher, or just generally, you know, what's your advice for those who are kind of thinking about, you know, moving into this kind of pathway?
Sure. No, as you'd expect, I would recommend it. I'd recommend it wholeheartedly, but I would kind of, you know, I'd list that with a sense of kind of realism as well. You know, I kind of did my kind of health services research. And I did a PhD quite late in my mid-40s, right? And I think the challenges that that posed for me as a, you know, as someone my age is there was a, you know, it was multifaceted. There was lots of factors at play there, right? Including how people, young people were studying completely changed. You know, the last time I was in a uni was, you know, decades ago, and I was just like, well, hang on, I don't quite get the systems. But slowly and surely, I got my head around the systems. The systems are the least of your worries. Mm-hmm. I think it takes a certain level of, faith, resilience, persistence, you know, self-belief to get through something like a PhD journey, for example, right? And it doesn't end there, you know, postdoc as well, you know, trying to get that funding, trying to get those, you know, as you say, early career opportunities. Mm-hmm. It's a constant battle, which will require perseverance, resilience, and self-belief. And I truly believe in, you know, if someone in my circumstance at my age can do that, by holding on strongly to the sense of self-belief that there, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, that's something, that's the strongest, kind of boldest, most useful bit of advice I could give to anyone getting into academia or considering a PhD. It's not just the systems, it's not just the subject knowledge, it's not just the educational journey or the curriculum. Mm. It's about self-development. It's about knowing within yourself, I can do this. I've got this. I will get through this. I might need some support, and it'll get tricky at times, and it'll get easier at times. Some of it will be enjoyable, but some of it won't. But you just got to keep towing the line. You got to keep trying to get to the end. Persevere.
Absolutely. Well, that's amazing advice. And I think I echo that, because I came into my PhD as a mature student as well. So high five to you. I'm going to have to get you back at some point to kind of think about some of the work that you've done around young people, because I think that's a really important topic, and I think we would really like to talk about that a bit more, but I'm conscious of the time in terms of the podcast, so we'll get you back at some point. So I'm going to end this here. I just want to thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for listening into this episode. I really hope that you were able to take away those key messages that Idrisar spoke about and begin to reflect on your own workplace and try and think about how we can make those spaces more inclusive for everyone that works within them. If you haven't done so already, as I mentioned at the beginning, go ahead, like, subscribe, so that you can get notified of all the latest episodes that are going to be coming up for this season. And genuinely, we have such a great lineup that you don't want to be missing out. Again, as always, send us your feedback, send us your comments. We love hearing from you. So until the next time, hopefully you're all going to be looking after yourselves, keep smiling, thriving. Take care. Bye-bye.